Access number 29039, Mr. Alan Pollock, Reel 12. Now, anything else about you? You know, your time with
Four Squadron.
Four Squadron, yes.
Yeah, I didn't mention really on 26 that we'd had a brief exchange with some Danes came down, and the squadron went up to Aalborg, and I was actually left at Oldenburg. But what that's leading up to is that on Four Squadron, we had two significant exercises which were pretty considerable, and one was a detachment to Schleswig Land, which was quite close up to the Danish border, and that was operating mainly over Denmark. Yeah, Schleswig Land was an airfield there, and we had Venoms on the airfield as well, and I think there might even have been, from memory, there might even have been a night fighter set up there as well. It was quite a crowded airfield, but really that was to practice what was still very much in the whole culture of 2nd Tactical Air Force, and that is the tactical element. Because every squadron was meant to stay tactical, and in fact...
Now, what do you mean by tactical?
Well, mobile, so that... and that was in their blood and their history, right, stretching back to the original role of 2nd Tactical Air Force, because the 1st Tactical Air Force you can consider was the Desert Air Force in a way, and the 2nd Tactical Air Force was developed for the whole Normandy and beyond in support of the army in terms of close air support. And we had two air forces out there, of course. We had 2nd Allied Tactical Air Force, which was the whole lot. 2nd TAF was the British element, and also we had Belgians, Dutch, and Germans as when they came in 2nd Allied Tactical Air Force. And then to the south, in a similar way, we had the Americans were there in the 4th Tactical Air Force. And the Americans also had the French down there.
So it's just involved. A matter of you moving the airfield.
Yep,
the ability to
bit
move
of that,
airfield and
right.
operate from a different airfield.
Yeah,
that's
but
what you
also the squadron had its own transport, and one of the first things that one did was learn to very quickly be taught how to drive a Magirus, the 3.5 tonner, which the squadron would. Commutes the wrong word to detach. Up to Sylt, for instance, there'd be a road party, a rail party, and then the air party. That was the way that normally the squadron went in three different elements. And what I was really getting around to saying was that we had the major exercise, which was, I'll get it in a minute, Brown Jug, Exercise Brown Jug, was up at Schleswig Land. And what was interesting there was we still had Venoms, so the last Venoms were still flying then, just before they disbanded, with us as part of a very composite, overcrowded airfield that had the runways slightly breaking up, because I can remember one of the problems we had with the Hunters was ingesting, actually sucking up bits of debris on the from the taxi tracks as people went round, and we had to be ultra careful on that, because obviously engine changes, anything in an aircraft like that in the Hunter was a very expensive and thing to in terms of time to get the engine changed. And the other big memory from Exercise Brown Jug was it was more low level than most.
Over Denmark,
and over those attractive islands, which I went to later, Fyn and elsewhere. And because it was that time of year, my other big memory was the mink. We had to mark in all the mink farms on our maps, and because I think the mink, sadly, if they got a fright, they would eat their young. And it was a completely different area of of flying there.
Now, what about this low-level? You haven't really talked about what you do in low-level flying. I mean, how would you practice it? Well, or was it just low-level flying? You weren't actually strapping anything? Or there was no range?
I think we were already later. We'd be doing far more of it. But I think already then we were doing simulated attacks, just beginning to start then, but not in such a disciplined way as one would do later, when we'd done far more air-to-ground firing, because the Hunter's guns were marvellous. I mean, you literally could get 80, 90% in good conditions against a 10-foot by 10-foot target on the ground.
So we'll come back to that. Now, what else? Anything else about exercise, Brown Joke?
I can remember the weather was far worse than it should have been, because it was, I think it was early summer from memory, and it was really surprisingly bad weather in the tented accommodation that we'd got, although we did have something a bit like a porter cabin now as our kind of crew room that actually extended outwards. So we were living in tented accommodation and, you know, all that lot, latrines on the Schleswig Land airfield. And the other major thing on 4 Squadron was the detachment down to the Canadians, which was a really extremely good eye-opener for us in many ways.
Now, where did you join them?
We went down to Baden-Solingen, which is near Baden-Baden.
Baden-Solingen?
Yeah, B-A-D-E-N, and Solingen is S-O-E, spelt the English way, or S-O with a umlaut on it, double L-I-N-G. E-N, and down at Bad Solingen, which was near Baden-Baden, there was a Sabre wing of the Canadians. They had Sabre 6s, and that had the Arenda engine, and was really one of the better Sabres. And although we used to sort of laugh at them a wee bit with what we call their pea shooters, they're much more small, because they had 0.5 guns from memory. And they weren't nearly as good as the punch you had with the Hunter. But the Sabre, with its slats down, and its all-flying tail, because the Americans, you probably know, the Americans withheld what they knew about the importance of the all-flying tail. And the Hunter had this follow-up tail, because you could actually trim your tail to operate like a slab, but only through the trimmer. And then they developed it that you had a follow-up tail, which I didn't think was so marvellous. I mean, some people say it was a great step forward, but I don't think in reality it was, in terms of helping you fly through this indeterminate area where you were on the compressibility side. In other words, around 0.9, it was, and just below 0.9, from 0.88 up to 0.93, 0.94, when you were tracking, there were trim changes and what have you, and it was a bit more difficult to fly. Whereas if you had a complete slab tail like the Sabre did, you know, you had far better control. But the other way round, we could always out accelerate the Sabres, and what was very useful about that was in terms of rough approximate comparison, was much more like the MiG that we'd be involved with and had to think about. So our flying against the Sabre was a very good exercise for us, because very quickly we learned, and again almost had a standard doctrine on 4 Squadron and the other squadrons that probably hadn't had this experience, that we would only attack them for the first 60 degrees. Once you turn through 60 degrees with them, and you hadn't got 2 or 3 seconds firing time on your cine, we would just dive down below them and climb up again to re-attack, because they could turn so much better at altitude. But to some extent we'd also learned that against the Venoms, because the Venoms also could turn better than us, and to some extent the Venom was remarkably good at high level, but far slower speed, you see. And it was this speed versus turn trade-off that is more complicated than you think in terms of the way you exercise. But we would then normally, whether or not you were with under control, you would climb up as fast as you could up Sun and then turn back with the Sun behind you, ideally, and attack the Sabres or anything else to try and get this killing film. In other words, coming down very quickly. But the Canadians, we found good pilots with their Sabres, and their serviceability was higher than ours. I think we had tended to have a bad serviceability patch then on that detachment, which sometimes happened. I mean, normally your serviceability improved, but for some reason down there, and I can remember how sad it was, because I think we put up a joint flypast, I can remember, and there were only three or four of our Hunters, and there were eight Sabres. Admittedly, they had a wing there as opposed to a squadron. And very hospitable people and very well paid. Dramatic change to where the Canadians were 20 years later. It was quite interesting. But to think back, they were even better paid, I think, than the Americans. And where we were probably taking out 50 marks with us or something like that, they seemed to be about four times as well off as we were. And I was very sadly, I spent a lot of beer money and flying the Sabre simulator and getting to know that. And both bosses apparently had come to some agreement. So I was not able to fly the Sabre. But watched one of my flight commanders not even able to taxi out of dispersal without being helped. And it really made me very angry, having spent a lot of time, you know, in the simulator with the Sabre. But that was very good experience for us, and it's called dissimilar combat because there's a limit to what you can learn from simulating fighting against the Hunter versus a Hunter. You've either got ideally got to expand that to against faster aircraft and against slower aircraft that can turn better.
Okay, anything that's very valuable. That anything else about your time with 4 Squadron? You were with them about a year, was it?
Yes, 11 months, I think it was. Yeah, and again, we were up at Sylt, and I can remember, as I say, 256 Squadron were up there. The Meteor, I think they'd still got Meteor 11s then, rather than the 14s, and I think that's virtually all I can remember. The swap to the boss, and again, the scores were getting better at Sylt, both from a pilot's point of view and also an element, it was improving the harmonization. I've got here that at low level, the average up there was 25%, so it had gone up. That was at low level and at medium level. So we were getting the harmonization better, but we hadn't got the radar ranging sorted out already, because the radar ranging would theoretically make the aircraft, we were firing peg ranging up at Sylt, on where you had a fixed, you set it about 240 yards from memory, and you're firing at probably 230 yards down to 200 in a short burst. But with the radar ranging, if everything was set up correctly, you would have spot on, your harmonization would be set, and with your radar ranging, you'd be far more likely to get a higher score.
So the radar range would adjust your harmonization, would it, to the exact range?
Well, no, your harmonization really... You're right in a way. It was really your aiming point would be automatically adjusted for your range to be virtually spot on. Yeah, the harmonization is more with the guns, and again, it would be separate, because up there we were firing the low velocity ammunition, because the low velocity ammunition didn't wear out your barrels so much. But as I mentioned, when in battle flight, we'd have the high velocity ammunition, which was no problem about firing on the sixes by then at any altitude. We tended not to fire 4 guns, but it was quite impressive to fire 4 guns, because immediately, if you had to do that for some reason, 10 knots would disappear straight away when you opened up with 4 guns at altitude over the sea. But we always just tended to fire the one gun and 100 rounds. I didn't mention the whole thing was done with colours on the flag. And I can vividly remember the daft thing of never having seen a flag on when I got to out to 26 Squadron, and then was down there, and it, very naively I complained about mine being all over the flag when the two senior pilots there. And I really had this daft thing in my head, like a gun on the ground, that they all ought to be grouped around the black dot. And of course, they were wild at my naivety, because the yellow marks were all down all down the flag, and somehow I'd managed to hit it all over the place. But it was that stupid naivety that I thought they all ought to be grouped, having never seen a flag at Chivna.
Now, so anything else before we leave 4 Squadron?
No, I think that's about it. I didn't mention before I left 26, because I think it probably slightly affected my assessment on my... you're assessed on your ability as a pilot, and I did quite well at Pembrey, but just before I left 26 to go up to 4 Squadron, I was flying down in a Vampire to Bukkeberg to pick someone up, and I was just about to be rated, which happened every year, and I knew my rating was coming up, and perhaps stupidly, but the other way around, it was a sensible thing to do. Even though I was by myself in this aircraft, I covered up the instruments to do the whole thing limited, even though I was going down through an awful lot of cloud, and Bukkeberg had me under control, and perhaps with all the extra, partly lack of experience and partly the fact that I was doing it on limited instruments, they were actually giving me reciprocals, which was still happening in those days occasionally. They would get things wrong, and instead of taking you to the overhead, they were actually taking me further and further away from the airfield. And because I hadn't got that much fuel at any rate, and gradually realised that they'd made a complete cock of getting me into Bukkeberg, I immediately went and made a security call on the fixer, which very rapidly, I was very impressed with that. And because by then I was heading and far closer to Hamburg Airport, I actually landed at Hamburg Airport, and that was a fascinating thing with the Vampire there. I can vividly remember to this day the SO, the Shell, and the BP tankers came up all ready to refuel me. I think more with normal high octane fuel rather than jet fuel, and I can remember feeling slightly strange in this civil airport with this Vampire. And although I had to explain it to the group captain and also the wing commander about how the whole thing had happened, I'm trying to think whether anything else from, yeah, but again, a very happy wing up there. I can remember, as I say, it was in the huts there, the accommodation, huts is probably the wrong word, was very good.
So how did you come to leave? It didn't seem a long posting.
No, well, the 11 months, quite quickly, the word got round that they were going to start this 5th Squadron again, which was going to be 26, and they really asked for volunteers, and they asked people if they wanted to go back. And I was very lucky, because... I just felt it would be a good thing to go back to 26. And 26, when it reformed down at Ahlhorn, I think it was literally within 2 days I was off. And I can remember John Farley, who became a very well-known Harrier test pilot later. He was one of the young pilots behind me at two remove. And I had to very rapidly hand over the inventory to him that I'd been working on for a long time. And often inventories like that with all the tools for a squadron and all the extra things, you really had to work on them literally for years. And two or three people gradually get it improved. And I don't think he ever forgave me, because I had to hand this over very quickly, and I remember being as honest as possible about it, but of course he saw it another way, and within 2 or 3 months I think they had quite a serious look at that inventory. But what I'm saying was, I was off the station very quickly, because the whole thing happened very rapidly, and I was given the CO's aircraft. I can remember it was the best aircraft at Yeva. He gave me Alpha, and I had my name put on it to fly down and deliver it, and then I came back for 3 days, I think, up to Yeva, and then came down.
So this is 26 Squadron, 124 Wing, and 2nd Tactical Air Force.
That's right. Now, in theory, we all considered ourselves as 124 Wing, but every station had a different wing. But 124, everyone on it, in other words, that was the old Oldenburg Wing, we always referred to ourselves to this day as 124 Wing, which is slightly incorrect, because Ahlhorn would have had another number. It might have been 121 Wing, I vaguely remember. But we always considered ourselves, even though we'd moved, because the wings really, the wing numbers went with the stations in 2nd TAF. Not many people know that. And 122 was Yeva, and it was just that, because of the sense of bonding, and that everyone on 124 Wing to this day, even though they went to three stations, Oldenburg, Ahlhorn, and then Gütersloh, just consider themselves as 124 Wing.
And it was actually what 121, you think, really? Well, you're not sure.
Yeah, I'm not sure now.
Now, where's Ahlhorn? How do you spell that?
A H L H O R N. And it was slightly out in the sticks in the Bundu. And they had Patriot missiles there, and I was able to see Ahlhorn last year, and they were just about to disappear off to the extreme eastern edge of Germany.
Now, what was the setup there then?
Ahlhorn was probably a smaller airfield, as I say, more out in the sticks. There was no really big town close to it. But what was quite unique, in a way, and my most vivid memory, in a way, or one of my more vivid memories, Ahlhorn was right in the middle of the large low flying area. And in the Air Force, there was this thing that you had limits what you were supposed to fly to, but people tended, particularly in 2nd TAF, to fly much lower, and you were not, in theory, you were only cleared down to fly at 250 feet, and you were not supposed to be below 250 feet, but people did fly lower than that, because it was thought operationally to be what you would have to do any rate. And at Ahlhorn, I can remember literally going off once on a sortie and never ever being above 250 feet because it was in the low flying, and I just went straight off after takeoff at low level and went all the way round and didn't do a dummy attack anywhere, and came right back in and just decelerated, told them what I was doing, and come in for a straight in approach, and the whole sortie, whatever it was, with those 200-gallon tanks by myself, I was never I was never above 250 feet, because you could do it legally there. Normally people came in and broke, but I thought it would be rather good never to go above 250 feet for the whole of a hunter trip. And the other lovely thing was then coming back on that wing and knowing the way that the GCIs operated. I haven't spoken about Green Salad, but we had in the Hunter a marvellous bit of kit that very few people used it, and it was really an anti-jamming aid, and it could tell you, if it was on, it could tell you where a transmission was being made, out to the left or out to the right, so you could actually home on a jamming aircraft. And it might have been used a bit more in UK, but I can only remember one exercise full play, I think it was called, where we we used it. And a lot of people, a lot of hunter guys to this day, some of them never even touched the button. But I twigged that straight away, that if one was doing an air test on a Sunday down at Ahlhorn or at Gütersloh, you could actually get the other wing scrambled, and by simply flying off right up to the border, turning north at high speed at 0.9, right on the deck, and then turn westwards and climb up westwards, and you would know roughly the two or three frequencies that the control would be on, but also you would know, and sometimes you could actually hear them being scrambled after you, because it was lovely to hear yourself announced as a supersonic target coming in from the east, because if you were climbing at 0.93, they'd often think you were climbing supersonic. And the controllers, then the other wing, the Ava wing would, the battle flight would pair would go off after you, and you would know, because you were either listening in, because you were on the right frequency, but often you weren't on the right frequency, but you could know their movements by using the green salad, which way they were attacking.
That was, why was it called green salad?
Oh, it was just a code word for it. But what was marvellous was when they were turning in on you at about a mile and a half or something like that, trying to get into you, you would turn the other way towards them, and from there chasing you very quickly, because they'd be under GCI control, it would take them, 15 seconds, 20 seconds to work out what you were doing. And very quickly, their voices all went high-pitched because the threat from the east was coming in right behind them then. And it was a rather splendid thing to do. And they enjoyed it, of course, because although they were probably quite shaken, very quickly they'd see that it was just another hunter. And we thought it was worthwhile for the training of the controllers and that. But it just illustrates what we were able to do then, the amount of flexibility that we had, which increasingly wasn't there in later years when the air defence identification zone came in.
Now, anything else about your time at Al Horn? I mean, what was the new squadron like? How was it bedding down together?
Well, I mentioned that in a way we had taken aircraft from the other squadrons. So effectively, although we'd got the 5th squadron, which was 26th squadron, as a Hunter 6 squadron, in fact there were no more aircraft on both the wings. They got the 5th squadron, and you could argue, I think it probably was a worthwhile thing that they did, and really I was very grateful to go back to 26, because very rapidly they had some two or three good blokes from the from UK, and some excellent armourers that had come from the Day Fighter Combat School, or the Day Fighter Leaders up at West Raynham at the Central Fighter Establishment on the armament side. And somehow the squadron gelled very well. We had a guy called Eddie Edmonds, who died a couple of years ago, but was a splendid wartime instructor guy. And he just had a very light touch, but we all respected him very much. And the squadron got on well with each other, and within a year, literally within 11 months, we were the top squadron of the top hunter squadron there, which winning the Duncan Trophy. And I think that was really for everything to do with air firing, but also I think we on combat and a whole variety of other things, you know, we felt we were the top squadron in 2nd TAF. And I didn't really mention that with the Hunter 6, we did feel then that we'd got a marvellous aircraft, you know, and a splendid role out there. And what I was mentioning earlier was that now, on 2nd 26, we were more and more switching to a lower level role, or a mix to start with. We were doing some of the battle flight as well, but more... The low-level role was coming up more. We were doing more air-to-ground, and we were even occasionally, because I can remember once going off with 400-gallon tanks, and the aircraft, the outer tanks hadn't been filled, and I remember doing a rapid calculation, because you basically only got 100 gallons worth because of the drag that you got with your four tanks, you only got really three tanks worth in terms of your planning of your usable fuel. And I can remember quickly working out in my head, there was no time to get it refueled fully, or I wouldn't have been able to get off from that sortie. And I worked out, because I was going way up to the North German border, that to do no more than one attack. And of course, when I got up there, I wanted to do a second attack, and then came creeping back and passing Oldenburg and wishing very much that, because that was, I think, the time I landed with the least fuel ever. And if you got in that business of not even daring to turn downwind, but just doing a straight-in approach and landing, and you'd have to brief the ground crew, you know, you'd have to say and trust them that they wouldn't let you down by telling how much fuel had gone in. And as I say, we were back then with 14 and 20 squadron were the other two squadrons.